From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Hong Kong protests shaping Taiwan election campaign. Myanmar releasing 3,000 prisoners. Pakistan and Afghanistan confront IS threat. These stories and more on this Wednesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Hong Kong students and government officials say they have reached an agreement to begin formal talks on demands for political reforms later this week. After a meeting with student representatives Tuesday evening, Undersecretary of Constitutional Affairs Lau Kong-hwa said talks with the territory's chief secretary, Carrie Lam, would begin on Friday. The news comes as most schools and businesses reopened as student-led protest sites dwindled to hundreds of participants, down sharply from the tens of thousands who filled the streets for more than a week. On Monday, the students and government officials announced a framework for formal talks, including equal status between the parties, multiple meetings, and a government commitment to carry out any agreements that are reached. Meanwhile, the mass protests against Chinese rule in Hong Kong are shaping election campaigns in Taiwan, which is self-ruled. But many citizens fear China will govern it someday as it pushes for unification. That has pressured Taiwan's ruling party and the more anti-China opposition party to make strong statements in favor of Hong Kong's protesters. Ralph Jennings reports for VOA in Taipei.
As far as relations with China are concerned, Taiwan's local elections in November are pivotal. Wins for the ruling Nationalist Party would help it keep the presidency in 2016 and would signal four more years of engagement with China, which claims sovereignty over the self-ruled island and wants to take it back eventually. Conversely, victories next month and in 2016 for the opposition Democratic Progressive Party could chill ties with China. It is within this context that the pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong figure to have an impact on politics in Taiwan and its relations with the mainland. Some Taiwanese are afraid of falling under Beijing's rule if their government engages China too aggressively. Shane Lee, a political scientist at Changzhou Christian University in Taiwan, says for that reason the president is under pressure to make a strong anti-China statement as the Hong Kong protests enter a second week.
People nowadays is generally in fear of PRC's taking over Taiwan, either by political means or economic means.
Taiwan President Ma Ying-jeou said in an interview with Al Jazeera Television in late September that universal suffrage would benefit Hong Kong's people and the Chinese government's international image. His government's Mainland Affairs Council urged China to listen to the demands of the people of Hong Kong and seek a consensus. Taiwan's opposition party last week asked China to honor what it described as a promise to allow democratic elections in Hong Kong. Tens of thousands have protested in Hong Kong since October 27 for universal suffrage to elect the territory's chief executive in 2017 and legislators in 2020. China, which took back the World Financial Center from the United Kingdom in 1997, wants a committee of 1,200 people, including many loyal to Beijing, to pre-select candidates. China has claimed Taiwan since the Chinese Civil War of the 1940s and insists the two sides eventually reunite. After Mr. Ma took office in 2008, his government ended decades of icy relations with communist China by sitting down to reach landmark economic agreements. The opposition party advocates more cautious engagement. When in power from 2000 to 2008, the party angered Beijing by pressing for Taiwan's legal independence from China. Tens of thousands protested in Taiwan in March and April this year as Parliament was about to ratify a service trade pact with China. Demonstrators said the deal would bring the two sides dangerously close despite possible economic benefits. That show of hostility has delayed ratification indefinitely and cast a shadow over President Ma's engagement with China. Chen Yixin, a professor of international affairs at Nanjiang University in Taiwan, said both parties feel pressure to take a tough stand now on China. He says that there are words that would normally be softer or more subtle, but that as elections approach, they cause both the Nationalists and the Democratic Progressive Party to speak in a louder tone. Chinese President Xi Jinping said last month he envisioned unifying with Taiwan under the same system that Beijing applies to Hong Kong. Taiwan rejected the suggestion but is studying whether the time is right for a first-ever meeting between the two presidents in Beijing next month. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
We have more at voanews.com. Myanmar's government has announced it is to free more than 3,000 prisoners before the country hosts a major regional political summit next month. But as VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok, it is not clear how many political prisoners are being released.
The Information Ministry in Yangon announced Tuesday it is conducting the mass release of prisoners before an auspicious full moon festival in the predominantly Buddhist country. Information Minister and Presidential Spokesman U Ye Tut tells VOA President Thein Sein ordered the amnesty.
The president issued a pardon for over 3,003 prisoners. And according to our information, the 3,015 Myanmar citizens and 58 foreigners. The president made this pardon based on the national reconciliation and also the humanitarian ground.
Former political prisoner Bo Chi says it appears only one of the more than 70 civilians still in prison for political offenses is being freed. The founder of the Assistance Association of Political Prisoners says the only such person he sees on the current pardon list fitting that description is named Marla. He notes 15 of those being released are ordinary elderly prisoners and some former military intelligence officers. Most notable among those freed is Brigadier General Thein Shwe, who was sentenced to 152 years in prison following the 2004 ouster of an ex-intelligence chief. Myanmar, also known as Burma, was under harsh military rule from 1962 through 2011. Since then, the army has been leading a transition to civilian democracy, with a general election promised for late next year. Since taking power in 2011, the president, who is a former general, has released more than 1,000 political prisoners and had pledged to release all of them by last year. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
North and South Korean warships exchanged warning shots near a disputed sea border Tuesday, days after the two sides agreed to high-level talks that many hope could improve inter-Korean relations. Seoul defense officials say a South Korean naval ship fired a warning shot after a North Korean vessel crossed the so-called northern limit line off the western coast. The North Korean ship returned fire before retreating. Such incursions are not uncommon since North Korea has never recognized the de facto Yellow Sea border, which was drawn by the United Nations at the end of the 1950s Korean War. There are signs the Islamic State terrorist organization is making inroads among militants operating in Pakistan. The Pakistan Taliban has responded to the group's reported expansion plan in South Asia by proposing what appears to be a loose alliance. Ayaz Ghul reports from Islamabad. Security officials say the country is prepared to deal with the threat because of its decade-long counter-militancy experience.
Islamic State propaganda pamphlets translated into local languages have been spotted in parts of northwestern Pakistan and Afghan border provinces in recent weeks, prompting concerns the group is seeking to expand its influence to a region already plagued by Islamist insurgencies. U.S. and Pakistani officials play down these reports as the acts of individuals influenced by social media and say they have yet to authenticate IS footprints in Afghanistan or Pakistan. Pakistani security officials say that recent stepped-up military offensives, particularly in North Waziristan tribal district near the Afghan border, are aimed at preventing militant networks like Islamic State from establishing influence or helping the Pakistani Taliban as the bulk of the U.S.-led coalition forces withdraw from Afghanistan. Army spokesman Major General Asim Saleem Bajwa tells VOA national security institutions have been asked to ensure developments in the Middle East do not undermine the country's ongoing counter-militancy efforts.
In today's globalized world, everything has a domino effect. It can spread anywhere across the world. We are very carefully watching all the developments in the region that we live in or beyond the region, and we take measures accordingly. We'll make sure that no terrorists carry out terrorist activities within the country and they don't use our soil for carrying out any activities elsewhere.
While a splinter group of the Pakistani Taliban has announced allegiance to the Islamic State, the Al-Qaeda-linked anti-Pakistan organization has not. This week, a statement from the fugitive leader of the Pakistani Taliban, Maulvi Fazlullah, praised the Islamic State battles in Syria and Iraq and promised to help their Muslim brothers if they asked for it. But he reiterated his group's allegiance remains with the leader of the Afghan Taliban, Mullah Omar. He also advised the Islamic State against hastily declaring people infidels and executing them. Pakistani columnist Zahid Hussain says the Islamic State has mainly benefited from the chaotic situations and collapsing state structures in Iraq and Syria. He says Pakistan has a robust security structure that has prevented Al-Qaeda and the Pakistani Taliban or TTP from imposing their extremist ideology on the country.
I think Pakistani state is still powerful to confront this challenge. And even Al-Qaeda or TTP have never been able to really actually make inroads among common Pakistanis.
Critics believe that without developing an effective long-term counter-terrorism strategy, countries like Pakistan will remain exposed to interventions by extremist forces like Islamic State. Afghan ambassador to Pakistan, Janan Musa Zai, says his country is also aware of the disastrous consequences if the Islamic State is able to take root in Afghanistan after international troops leave.
The terrorists, they recognize each other, they work with each other, they support each other. And to be able to tackle them effectively, to be able to defeat them, we have to be able to come together, our security institutions, our armies, our intelligence agencies, because otherwise this evil will only get bigger and more dangerous.
Ahmad Bilal Sufi is a former Pakistani law minister.
I think the starting point should be to make sure that those who are in the jails as inmates in some of these countries are also taken through the process of de-radicalization as a national strategy. Because a lot of people that eventually find their way out from the judicial system either through bail or through acquittals are the primary feeding ground for the IS phenomena.
Sufi says that Pakistan has detained as many as 3,000 suspected militants in counter-militancy operations around the country over the past many years. But he says that the national judicial system lacks the capacity to expeditiously try and sentence these people. He says Pakistan's leaders have not yet devised a policy to address the issue. The militants operating in Pakistan come from the country's majority Sunni population. Some observers worry that a possible rise of the fiercely anti-Shiite Islamic State could fuel a bloody sectarian conflict with the country's minority Shiite population. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
Indian and Pakistani forces, meanwhile, continued to exchange fire Tuesday across the border between Indian-controlled Kashmir and Pakistan in renewed violence. Nine people were killed Monday, marking the highest civilian death toll in the conflict over the disputed Kashmir region in more than a decade. Each side has accused the other of provoking the violence. It has been described as one of the worst violations of the 2003 ceasefire between the two countries. The announcement last week that the United States is partially lifting an arms ban on Vietnam has been welcomed as an important step in warming ties between the two nations. However, human rights activists have criticized the move. Marianne Brown reports from Hanoi.
Despite coming just months after a Chinese oil rig stationed in waters also claimed by Vietnam sparked a tense standoff between the two countries, the State Department was keen to stress the move to ease a ban on selling arms to Vietnam was not anti-China. Instead, it said the decision was partly a response to a lack of maritime capacity in the region. Dr. Ian Storey, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore, says the decision was definitely hastened by the oil rig crisis.
It underscores America's increasing concern about recent developments in the South China Sea and in particular how Chinese assertiveness is seen as potentially undermining U.S. interests in the region.
The move to ease the ban is largely symbolic, Story says, because Vietnam has a long-standing relationship with Russia to buy much cheaper equipment. The speculation is that Vietnam is interested in purchasing the P-3 Orion patrol aircraft used for marine surveillance. Vietnam has been lobbying the US to lift the ban for several years, but one condition set by Washington was an improvement in human rights. Story again.
So they've got around this issue partly by saying, well, Vietnam has improved its human rights situation, although it's not a vast improvement on what it was. But secondly, they've said that we'll provide non-lethal equipment to Vietnam to improve its maritime domain awareness. So we're not talking about submarines or warships, but equipment that would enable Vietnam to improve its maritime surveillance capabilities in its EEZ.
In an article for Foreign Policy, Asia Advocacy Director for Human Rights Watch, John Sifton, criticised the move, saying it undercuts the brave work of Vietnamese activists who look to the US to pressure Vietnam into improving its human rights record. Le Quoc Quyet is the younger brother of Le Quoc Quan, one of Vietnam's most high-profile dissidents, who was jailed last year for tax evasion, a charge critics say was politically motivated.
I think U.S. concern, the concern about human rights in Vietnam, but this is not a precondition, because they have to concern many other issues besides human rights, you know.
The U.S. State Department has said that Vietnam still needs to improve its human rights record, and Washington continues to evaluate its security relationship with Hanoi. Nguyen Chi Zum is the son of dissident blogger Dio K, who is serving a 12-year prison sentence for conducting propaganda against the state. Zum said last week for the first time his father received a visit from officials from the US embassy. Up until now, he has only been allowed to meet family. It is a sign, Zum believes, that the Vietnamese government is considering his release. He believes this is connected to the partial lifting of the arms embargo.
So I think that if my father is released, it must be something to deal with it about the deal. I know them for a long time, the Vietnamese government. They will not do anything with that profit.
However, while his family welcome the possibility, Zum says he agrees that the US should not sell arms to Vietnam, while the latter's track record on human rights remains poor. He says he thinks if his father is set free, he will not be allowed to stay in Vietnam and would likely be offered exile in the United States. While speculation lingers on what equipment Vietnam will purchase, the decision is likely to send ripples through Vietnam's internal factions, as some of them seek closer ties with the US against China. So far, Beijing has not commented on the move. This is Marianne Brown for VOA News in Hanoi.
A Vietnam-flagged tanker with 18 crew members on board has gone missing since leaving Singapore for a Vietnamese port last Thursday. It's raising fears it has fallen into the hands of pirates. The vessel was carrying more than 5,200 tons of oil products and was scheduled to arrive at its destination Sunday. Vietnamese search and rescue authorities tell VOA's Vietnamese service that they lost radio contact with the tanker less than an hour after its departure. The way students communicate not only with each other, but with just about everyone and every other aspect of their lives has changed over the past decade. Colleges and universities are constantly trying to find the most direct, effective, and economical ways of accomplishing that task. A study has been released focusing on the students who would like to attend schools. Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Simone Bezaziro, a spokesperson for QS, a London-based research company specializing in higher education. She says the study was carried out to explore how prospective students use digital resources to research higher educational options.
Well, essentially, the findings are revealing something quite interesting. According to the sample of students we have interviewed across the world, and it is a pretty significant one because we had 2,215 responses, they are telling us that online resources are indispensable, but offline resources remain almost equally valued. And what is even more interesting is that the younger part of this group are telling us that they really, really appreciate receiving information also offline, which, intuitively we wouldn't have expected.
It had to be surprising, but tell me first, is this sampling representative of the entire world or just the developed world? What about the underdeveloped world?
Well, I mean, in terms of representation, 53% of responses were from prospective students in Europe, 25% came from Asia, 11% Latin America, 8% were in the US and Canada, and 4% came from Africa. We had more females participating than males, so the ratio was 55 versus 45%.
Did they give reasons why they still wanted the non-digital sort of communication?
Well, essentially what happens is that they like the speed of response that they receive via social media, via Twitter or Facebook, when it comes to basically universities that are very well equipped to do so. But at the same time, they appreciate receiving information via emails. You know, over 70% of them told us that that's their preferred method to inquire about very detailed information and to receive detailed responses. But they also value receiving prospectuses. You know, it's probably a more tangible form of information.
What does this mean for colleges and universities?
Well, what is important, in our opinion, is that obviously colleges and universities keep investing on improving their outreach by embracing new media and social media fully. But at the same time, they need to realize that traditional forms of communication are still a very good investment. And also that they need to sort of really think of the relationship that they build with students at the crucial time, which is the time when they're deciding, as a relationship that needs to be built across multiple platforms.
Did the study address what the priorities were of students from different regions of the world?
Well, I mean, what the study wanted also to find out were which were the most commonly used devices for students. And what has emerged is that in developing countries, obviously they prefer to access information using smartphones because these are the most affordable and readily available digital devices. For the rest of the world, laptops are still very much used. And what is also interesting is that we asked which information they are struggling to find online. And what has emerged is that universities should try to make life easier for students that are looking for scholarships, bursaries, and financial aid, because that type of information is not necessarily, easily found on universities' websites. And also students, especially from Asia, are asking for clear information and directions about visa requirements, especially if they intend to study, outside the region.
Simone Bizzazero, a spokesperson for QS, a London-based research company specializing in higher education, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Ira Melman. We'll be hearing from Steve Norman. He's next with the latest world news on International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA space Chinese to get your free Chinese language iPhone app from VOA.